A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Hey, Herman and Corin. If we ask somebody to name a dish that sounded quintessentially medieval or represented what they might imagine to be a grim time in history before refrigeration and burritos came on the scene, they might point to cottage. Cottage, immortalized by Oliver Twist. For those who have tried to recreate medieval pottage recipes, it is kind of grim. We've talked before about surviving without a refrigerator and this concept of the eternal pot. Like, you can actually preserve food by never letting it cool. And I recall reading once that when we're looking for chasing down recipes for medieval pottage, as most well-adjusted people do on their weekends, there isn't really a recipe, because it's essentially pottage was what was available, was put into a pot and consumed. I have a few unresolved questions about pottage floating around my brain, as maybe most people do. Number one is, was pottage this kind of just constant pot that was literally, an eternal pot, as some call it, it was just kind of kept there. And you just literally would kind of come back from the market or wherever you could find food and threw in a few potatoes and turnips to try to bring a bit of life to it. And that was kind of being mixed in with whatever else was cooking there. Like, was that kind of the way it worked? These days, it's, I would say, pottage culture is at a low ebb. There are some people who still enjoy pottage, but it's not something you really see much in cookbooks. But, and this is the but, if we think about Jewish food, Shabbat food, some of the most amazing food is slow cooked. And there's a huge culture in Judaism of food that was cooked overnight on low simmer. And you always get these flavors that you just can't recreate any other way, including from an instant pot, which promises to kind of take slow cooking and speed it up. But you never quite get those same flavors. And I guess you could, I have a friend, Joel Haber, who has produced books about Jewish food. And if pottage is less a single dish and more a kind of ethos of cooking, lots of traditional Jewish dishes qualify as pottage. They have the requisite elements that we think of as pottage classics, the grains, barley, beans, and particularly those two things in combination, which can form a complete protein, and meat on the Shabbat. So Herman and Corin, I'd love to talk about the history of pottage as it's been enjoyed from what we imagine its heyday to be in the Middle Ages through to how it lives on in today's culinary history. Herman and Corin, over to you.
Daniel sent us this one, and it's a layered one. He's asking about pottage, the medieval catch-all stew that's been immortalized as the grim gray sludge of history, and whether the eternal pot thing was real. But then he connects it to something I genuinely hadn't considered. The idea that Jewish Shabbat cooking, cholent and haman, the slow overnight stuff, might actually be pottage's living descendants. That's the hook. Is pottage dead, or did it just change its name and get a lot better?
I love this question. It takes something everybody thinks they know. Pottage equals sad peasants eating gruel, and just pulls the thread. What unravels is a whole history of how humans kept themselves fed for thousands of years using techniques we mostly forgot. The eternal pot thing? There were stews that stayed hot for decades.
Not a typo.
Not a typo. There's a documented perpetual stew in Normandy that ran from the 1500s until World War II. Another one in Perpignan. Same idea. You keep the pot over a low fire, add whatever comes in, ladle out meals, and the constant simmering keeps it microbiologically safe. It's a thermal equilibrium where the temperature never drops into the danger zone.
the medieval version of a sourdough starter, except instead of flour and water. It's...
And that's the key to understanding pottage as a category rather than a recipe. The word comes from Old French pottage, literally, what's in the pot. That's not a recipe, that's a framework. You had your base, usually grain, barley, oats, rye, simmered in water or stock. Then whatever walked past the kitchen door. Vegetables, legumes, scraps of meat if you had them, herbs if you grew them. The poor ate pottage that was mostly grain and beans. The rich ate pottage that was essentially meat stews with grain as thickener.
Pottage was the entire socioeconomic spectrum of medieval food under one name. Oliver Twist wasn't begging for what Henry VIII was eating.
Oliver Twist's gruel, please sir, I want some more, was workhouse pottage, the bottom of the barrel. Workhouses in Dickens's time served watery oatmeal gruel designed to be just barely nutritious enough to keep orphans alive while being so unpleasant nobody would choose to be there. It was deterrence food. Medieval pottage for actual working people was a lot better, because if you were a peasant doing 14 hours of field labor, you needed calories and nutrients.
Dickens gave pottage a branding problem it never recovered from.
One novel, one scene, and 1,000 years of human cuisine is reduced to gray slop. But pottage was what kept Europe alive. It was the primary way humans consumed grains for millennia. Bread was expensive. You needed an oven, which meant fuel, which meant cost. Pottage just needed a pot and a fire. Every household had a cauldron, probably the most important piece of kitchen equipment a medieval family owned, and in some places it was literally listed in wills.
Which makes sense. You can't inherit a sandwich.
You can't, but you can inherit the vessel that feeds your family for 3 generations, and that's where the eternal pot concept comes from. It wasn't just convenience, it was fuel economy. Keeping a fire going 24/7 was expensive. If you let the pot cool completely and had to bring it back to a boil every day, you burned through your wood supply. Keeping it just barely simmering overnight was the efficient move.
The eternal pot wasn't some mystical tradition. It was just not wanting to chop more firewood.
The most profound cultural practices usually come down to not wanting to do more work. But here's where Daniel's connection to Jewish cooking gets really interesting. What he's describing, kolent, haman, dafina, are essentially pottage that solved a specific religious constraint, and in doing so, preserved the technique into the modern era.
Walk me through that constraint.
In Jewish law, you can't cook on Shabbat. No lighting a fire, no active food preparation. But you're also supposed to eat hot food on Shabbat as part of honoring the day. So the solution, developed over centuries, was to prepare a slow-cooked stew before sundown Friday, put it in a sealed pot, and leave it in a residual heat oven or over a low flame lit before Shabbat began. It cooks for 12 to 18 hours. By Saturday lunch, you have this incredibly deep, melded, almost jammy stew.
That's pottage.
That's pottage. The base is almost always grains and beans. Barley and chickpeas, barley and kidney beans, wheat berries and fava beans, plus meat if you could afford it, potatoes after the Columbian Exchange, onions, garlic, spices, depending on where you were. The Sephardic haman often includes eggs that slow cook in the shell until they turn brown and creamy. Ashkenazi kollel often has kishke, a stuffed casing filled with grain and fat. These are all variations on what's available goes in the pot and cooks a long time.
Kollel is pottage with a theological engine.
And the theological engine meant that while the rest of Europe gradually abandoned the perpetual stew, as fuel became cheaper and cooking technology improved, Jewish communities kept the technique alive and refined it. They iterated on it. They made it delicious in a way medieval peasants probably never could, because they had the Sabbath as a weekly deadline that demanded excellence.
The weekly deadline that demands excellence. That's the best description of Jewish cooking I've ever heard.
It connects to something the prompt mentions about instant pots not quite getting there. There's a chemical reason. When you cook something for 18 hours at low temperature, you're doing things to the food that cannot happen in 45 minutes at high pressure.
What kind of things?
Maillard reactions at low temperature over long periods. Collagen breakdown that converts tough connective tissue into gelatin. Starches that slowly absorb liquid and break down into sugars, which then caramelize at the edges of the pot. The beans release their starches gradually, thickening the liquid into something that's neither broth nor sauce, but a third thing. Then there's the interaction between ingredients. Barley absorbs meat juices, beans absorb onion sweetness, everything exchanges flavors over hours. An instant pot can get things tender, but it can't replicate time. Time is an ingredient.
Time is an ingredient. I'm putting that on a tea towel.
You should, and then sell it to people who own Le Creuset pots. But the science backs it up. There's a reason slow-cooked food tastes different, and it's not nostalgia. It's the Maillard cascade, the gelatin conversion, the gradual caramelization of whatever's touching the sides of the pot. Those brown bits that form on the edge of a chalent pot after 16 hours, that's flavor that didn't exist when you put the lid on.
What was medieval pottage actually like? If we're busting the Oliver Twist myth, what did a reasonably well-off peasant's pottage taste like?
Seasonal would be the first word. Medieval pottage wasn't one thing year-round. Spring brought fresh herbs, parsley, sage, thyme, marjoram, and early greens like sorrel, nettles, young leeks. Summer might include peas, beans, fresh vegetables from the garden. Autumn was the rich season. Root vegetables, maybe meat from the autumn slaughter, grains from the harvest. Winter pottage was the lean one. Dried beans, stored grains, salted meat if you had it, root vegetables from the cellar.
Pottage was basically a seasonal ingredient delivery system.
It was the medieval CSA box. You ate what was available. That's why there are no real recipes. The recipe was look around, put it in the pot. The 12th century writer Alexander Neckam described what he called honest pottage, beans, chickpeas, other vegetables with a piece of bacon if possible. That's not a recipe, that's a suggestion with a pork clause.
A suggestion with a pork clause is my new favorite genre of medieval literature.
The form of curie, a 14th century English cookbook from Richard II's court, has pottages that are luxurious. Almond milk, saffron, sugar, expensive spices. And then you've got peasant pottage that's barley and leeks and whatever fell off the cart. Same word, completely different universes.
Pottage is like the word salad today. Iceberg lettuce and ranch dressing, or a $40 grain bowl with pomegranate seeds and heritage farro. Same category. Vastly different experiences.
That's the analogy. And just like salad, the category is defined more by structure than ingredients. Pottage is a grain-based liquid medium, one-pot meal. Everything else is variable.
Let's talk about the grain base, because the prompt mentions barley and beans forming a complete protein. That feels modern. Were medieval people aware of that?
They were eating what worked empirically. Nobody in the 12th century understood amino acid profiles. But they knew, through generations of trial and error, that barley and beans together kept you alive better than either alone. That combination, grain plus legume, shows up across almost every peasant cuisine in the world. Rice and lentils in India, corn and beans in Mesoamerica, barley and chickpeas in the Middle East, oats and peas in Scotland. The human palate figured out complete protein long before biochemistry named it.
Pottage was nutritionally optimized by accident.
The people who ate badly died. The people who ate grain and bean stews lived long enough to have children who also ate grain and bean stews. That's not recipe development, that's natural selection with a ladle.
Natural selection with a ladle. You're on fire today.
I'm passionate about stew, but here's what connects back to Daniel's observation. Collant and Hammond preserve exactly that grain plus legume core. Ashkenazi collant is typically barley and beans, sometimes with potatoes added after the 1600s. Sephardic Hammond is often wheat berries and chickpeas. Defina, the Moroccan version, includes rice and chickpeas, sometimes with meat, eggs, or dates for sweetness. These are all variations on the same nutritional engine that powered medieval Europe.
The Jewish diaspora preserved and regionalized pottage while the rest of Europe moved on.
Yes, and there's a reason beyond Shabbat cooking laws. Jewish communities were often poor, restricted in professions, where they could live, what ingredients they could access. Pottage is the cuisine of constraint. You work with what you have, stretch what's expensive, fill the pot with what's cheap. That's collant. It assumes you need to feed a family on, not very much, every single week.
The result is delicious. I've had cholent. It's not Oliver Twist food.
It's not. A well-made cholent, after 16 hours, has this depth that's almost impossible to describe. The barley becomes almost creamy. The beans break down slightly and thicken the liquid. The meat is falling apart. And there's this brown crust that forms on top called the kara in Yiddish. The concentrated essence of everything that's been cooking. People fight over the kara.
There are food fights in synagogue over pot crust.
I have witnessed them. I have participated in them. The Kara is the prize.
Let's go back to the Eternal Pot. You've got a pot simmering for weeks or months. How do you not die?
Pathogens can't survive above about 140 degrees Fahrenheit. A simmering pot sits at around 180 to 210. As long as you keep it there, nothing harmful can grow. You top up the liquid, add ingredients, stir, serve, and the thermal mass of the pot, plus the fire, kept everything safe.
What about the stuff at the bottom? After 3 months, isn't there just...
There's a technique. Some traditions used a pot with a rounded bottom that made it easier to stir everything up and prevent scorching. In others, you'd periodically empty the pot, clean it, and pour the liquid back in, which technically resets the eternal clock, but the flavor base continues. The famous Normandy Perpetual Stew apparently had a rhythm where the pot was never fully emptied, but the solids were cycled through. It's not that the same molecules were in there for 300 years. It's that the pot was never without some portion of the previous batch.
Like a sourdough starter. You feed it, use some, feed it again. The starter in my kitchen isn't literally the same flour from 3 years ago, but it's a continuous culture.
And that's why the Cullen connection is so apt. A Cullen pot isn't perpetual in the strict sense. It gets eaten completely every Saturday, the pot gets cleaned, and next week you start fresh. But the technique, the slow, low heat, the grain and bean base, the long melding of flavors, that is the direct descendant of medieval pottage. It's pottage that got religion and a weekly schedule.
What about other modern descendants outside Jewish cooking?
The most obvious is French pot au feu, essentially refined pottage where broth and solids are served separately. The broth becomes a first course, the meat and vegetables the main course. That's pottage with table manners.
Pottage that went to finishing school.
Pottage with a trust fund. Then you've got Spanish cocido, Italian bolito misto, New England boiled dinner, Scottish cock-a-leeky, essentially barley pottage with chicken and leeks. Even the full English breakfast has a pottage ancestor. Medieval English breakfast was often pottage made with ale instead of water, which sounds considerably better.
That's breakfast.
That's breakfast before coffee existed. You got your calories and mild intoxication simultaneously.
The medieval equivalent of a breakfast burrito and a Red Bull.
We haven't even touched the sweet side. Fromity was a medieval pottage made with cracked wheat, milk, and sugar or honey, sometimes with dried fruit, served at celebrations. It's essentially the ancestor of rice pudding and oatmeal. Pottage wasn't just savory, it was the entire food system.
When we say pottage, we're talking about the default human meal for roughly 1,000 years.
Boiling grains in liquid predates the medieval period by millennia. We have archaeological evidence of Neolithic people boiling grains in pots. Pottage is one of the oldest cooked foods in human history. Bread gets all the glory, but pottage kept more people alive for more of history.
Bread is the Instagram food of the ancient world. Pottage is the reliable friend who shows up every day and doesn't need to be photographed.
And the prompt asks whether pottage culture is at a low ebb. I'd argue it's not. It just changed its name and diversified. Every slow-cooked stew, every grain bowl, every one-pot meal, every set-it-and-forget-it, Sunday dinner is pottage's descendant. The Instant Pot is a pottage machine. We just don't call it that because the branding is terrible.
Nobody's buying the Instant Pottage.
The Instant Pottage Pro, with a medieval mode that runs for 18 hours and doesn't let you open the lid. But seriously, the slow cooker revival, the obsession with braising, the entire meal prepping movement where you dump ingredients in a pot on Sunday and eat all week, that's pottage. We're living through a pottage renaissance, and we don't even know it.
What's the difference between modern slow cooking and medieval pottage, besides the technology gap?
The biggest difference is the quality and variety of ingredients. A medieval peasant couldn't buy coconut milk, lemongrass, chipotle peppers, fish sauce, miso paste. They had what grew within walking distance and what could be stored through winter. Modern slow cooking has access to global ingredients. The technique is the same. Low heat, long time, one pot, but the flavor palette is unimaginably broader.
We're living in the golden age of pottage, and we're too snobby to admit it.
We're living in the golden age of pottage, and we call it slow food, or comfort food, or meal prep, because pottage sounds like something you'd be punished with. But the fundamental appeal is the same. Pottage is easy, forgiving, takes cheap ingredients and makes them taste expensive, feeds a lot of people on not much money. Every culture on Earth has a version of this.
The prompt mentioned a friend named Jordan Haber, who's written about Jewish food. The idea that traditional Jewish dishes qualify as pottage, is that a stretch?
It's historically accurate. The grain-bean-meat combination in a slow-cooked one-pot meal is as pottage gets. The only thing distinguishing collet from medieval pottage is that collet has a specific religious context and a name that survived. Medieval pottage didn't have a specific name because it was the default. You didn't call it pottage, you called it dinner.
The way fish don't have a word for water.
Pottage, as a distinct category, only emerges when there's something to contrast it with. Once you have ovens and roasting and baking and frying as common techniques, suddenly the stuff in the pot becomes a specific choice rather than the only option. Before that, it's just cooking.
The word pottage is itself a sign that pottage was already in decline.
The moment you name something, you've already started to lose it. We don't have a word for phone-based communication, because that's just what phones are. We had a word for landline, only after mobile phones existed.
What did medieval people actually call pottage?
Probably whatever the main ingredient was. The nursery rhyme peas porridge hot, peas porridge cold, peas porridge in the pot 9 days old. That's literally describing an eternal pot of pea pottage. 9 days old was a feature, not a bug. The rhyme is documenting the practice.
Wait, that nursery rhyme is about the eternal pot.
It's about the eternal pot. Peas porridge hot, the pot freshly heated. Peas porridge cold, the fire's died down, but the pot's still safe. Peas porridge in the pot 9 days old. The perpetual stew, still edible because it's been kept at temperature. The rhyme is a medieval food safety manual disguised as a children's song.
I'm going to need a moment. I've known that rhyme my entire life and never once thought about what it actually meant.
Most people haven't. It's so familiar it's invisible. But 9 days old isn't random, it's specific. 9 days was probably about the maximum you'd want to keep a perpetual pot going before the flavors got.
Challenging is doing a lot of work there.
Medieval sources do complain about pottage going off, becoming sour or unpleasant. The eternal pot wasn't perfect. It required attention, stirring, keeping the fire right, adding enough new material to keep the balance. It was a living system, and living systems can crash.
Like adopting a feral cat.
A feral cat made of barley and regret.
Let's circle back to the Cholent connection. What are the specific dishes that qualify?
Cholent is the Ashkenazi version. Barley, beans, potatoes, beef or brisket, if available, onions, garlic, paprika, sometimes kishka. It goes into the oven or onto a blech, a metal sheet over a low flame before Shabbat begins Friday and cooks until Saturday lunch. Hamin is the broader Sephardic category. The word comes from the Hebrew, sham, meaning hot. The Iraqi version, tabit, is chicken stuffed with rice, slow-cooked with more rice, spices, and sometimes tomatoes. Moroccan tafina, or skina, includes chickpeas, rice or wheat berries, meat, potatoes, eggs, and sometimes dates or honey. The Yemenite version often includes hawaj, a spice blend with cumin, turmeric, and cardamom. Every Jewish community has a version, and every version is essentially pottage adapted to local ingredients and tastes.
All share that grain legume core.
All of them. Even when rice replaces barley, you still have chickpeas or beans. The complete protein principle is preserved across every variation. Jewish cooks figured out, through the same empirical process as everyone else, that grain plus legume equals a meal that sustains you through a day of prayer and rest without leaving you hungry.
Without requiring you to cook, which is the whole point.
The Shabbat constraint forced innovation. You couldn't just make a quick meal between synagogue and lunch. You had to have something ready that had been cooking unattended for 12 hours or more. That requirement eliminated almost every cooking technique except slow braising. So Jewish cooks got really, really good at slow braising.
Necessity is the mother of invention, and religious law is the mother of really good stew.
The Talmud actually discusses this. There's a passage in Tractate Shabbat about hatmana, insulating food for Shabbat. The rabbis debated what materials could be used to keep food hot without actually cooking it further. The principle was established, you can retain heat, but you can't add heat. That debate, happening 2,000 years ago, is the direct ancestor of every collet pot.
We have rabbinical legal debates from the first century, essentially about how to optimize pottage.
And that's what makes this history so rich. Pottage isn't just peasant food. It's peasant food that got theological attention, that got written about, debated, refined, and passed down through generations with intentionality. Most peasant cuisines are oral traditions that disappear when the culture changes. Jewish pottage got written into law and ritual, which preserved it.
That's a remarkable argument. Religious obligation acted as a cultural preservation mechanism for a cooking technique that otherwise might have been abandoned.
It's not just cooking. You see the same thing with language, music, textile arts. Practices that become religious obligations survive in ways that practices that are merely traditional don't. Sholin isn't just something Jews eat, it's something Jews are supposed to eat, or at least something that solves a problem Jews are supposed to solve. The hot Shabbat meal is a requirement. Sholent is the solution. The solution survived.
What does this mean for the modern home cook who's not Jewish, not keeping Shabbat, but wants to understand pottage as a living tradition? What do they make?
They make a slow-cooked one-pot meal with grains and legumes and whatever else they have. That's the recipe. But if they want something specific, make a cholent. It's the most direct descendant of medieval pottage that's still widely made and well documented. Get some barley, some beans, kidney or navy beans work, some beef chuck or brisket if you eat meat, or don't if you don't, onions, garlic, paprika, salt, pepper. Put it in a heavy pot with a tight lid. Put it in the oven at 225 degrees before you go to bed. Eat it for lunch the next day. That's pottage.
That's remarkably straightforward.
Pottage is remarkably straightforward. That's the whole point. It's supposed to be what you make when you don't have time, money, or attention to spare, and you still need to feed people. The fact that it also happens to be delicious after 12 hours is just the reward for not overthinking it.
The prompt mentions instant pots don't quite get the same flavors. Is that real? Or food snobbery?
It's real. An instant pot operates at higher pressure and temperature than a slow oven. It forces liquid into the food faster, which speeds up cooking but changes the texture. It also doesn't allow for evaporation, so flavors don't concentrate the same way. And critically, it doesn't allow for edge caramelization, those brown bits that form where food touches the sides of the pot above the liquid line. In a slow oven, those bits develop over hours and get stirred back in, adding depth. An instant pot can't do that because the cooking environment is saturated steam throughout.
The instant pot is missing, the Maillard cascade you mentioned.
It's missing the low and slow Maillard reactions. It can brown things if you use the sauté function first, but that's initial browning, not the gradual caramelization that happens over 12 hours. Different chemistry, different flavor.
The instant pot is pottage for people in a hurry, and the whole philosophy of pottage is that you shouldn't be in a hurry.
That's it exactly. Pottage is slow food, not as a lifestyle choice, but as a structural necessity. The slowness isn't a feature you add, it's the thing that makes the technique work. When you try to speed it up, you're making a different dish. It might still be good, but it's not pottage.
There's something almost meditative about that. The idea that some food just takes time, and the time isn't wasted. It's doing work that can't be done any other way.
Time is an ingredient, I meant that. And in an era where everything is optimized for speed, there's something countercultural about a cooking technique that says, this will be ready tomorrow, and that's the point.
Pottage as resistance.
Pottage as resistance. The slow cooker as a tiny rebellion against the tyranny of the instant.
I'd buy that tea towel, too.
You're building quite the merchandise line.
Let's talk about the sensory experience. What does a good cholent or pottage actually taste like?
Deeply savory, first of all. The long cooking breaks down proteins and starches into amino acids and sugars, which recombine into hundreds of new flavor compounds. There's a richness you don't get from quick cooking. The barley becomes almost creamy, but still has a slight chew. The beans soften, but hold their shape if you've used the right variety. The liquid thickens into something that coats the back of a spoon. If there's meat, it's falling apart, and its fat has rendered into the grain, carrying flavor into every bite.
You're making me hungry, and it's not even close to lunch.
Good cholent has layers. You taste the sweetness of slow-cooked onions first, then the earthiness of the beans, then the grain, then the spice, and then this long savory finish that just keeps going. The kara, that crust on top, is concentrated, almost caramelized, slightly chewy. It's the best part. People arrive at synagogue early specifically to get the kara before someone else does.
There's a black market in pot crust.
An underground economy. The kara futures market is volatile.
We've established that Pottage isn't grim, wasn't always grim, and has living descendants that are excellent. What's the biggest misconception you want to bust?
That medieval food was bad. It's the most persistent myth in food history, and it's wrong. Medieval people weren't stupid. They had access to fresh herbs, good grains, seasonal vegetables, and they knew how to cook them. They didn't have refrigeration, so they developed preservation techniques. Salting, smoking, drying, fermenting, and yes, perpetual stewing. That worked. A well-made medieval pottage with fresh herbs, good barley, and a bit of bacon would be a perfectly pleasant meal today. Not restaurant food, but a solid, satisfying dinner.
The Oliver Twist version was deliberate misrepresentation.
It was propaganda. Dickens was making a point about the cruelty of the workhouse system, and he used deliberately awful, inadequate food to make that point. It worked as literature, but it poisoned the reputation of an entire category of cooking for 150 years.
The power of a good sentence.
Please, sir, I want some more. And suddenly pottage is forever associated with starving orphans and watery gruel. No PR team could fix that.
What's the modern pottage we should all be eating?
If you want to taste what medieval pottage might have been like at its best, make a barley and bean stew with good stock, fresh herbs, and a smoked ham hock. Cook it low and slow for at least 4 hours. If you want to taste pottage's most refined descendant, find a Jewish friend who makes kolend, or find a recipe and make it yourself. If you want to taste pottage as a global phenomenon, make a Persian ash, e-reshta, a bean and noodle soup with herbs and fermented whey that's essentially Persian pottage, and it's extraordinary.
Ash-e-reshta. That's a new one for me.
It's a thick soup of kidney beans, chickpeas, lentils, noodles, spinach, dill, and mint, topped with fried onions and kashk, a fermented whey product. It's been made in Iran for centuries. It's pottage. The grain component is the noodles. The legumes are the beans and lentils. The herbs make it distinct. Same structure, different continent.
Pottage is basically a universal human food that we've arbitrarily decided to call different things in different places.
And we've arbitrarily decided the English word for it sounds unappetizing. Call it a grain bowl or a braise or a slow-cooked stew, and suddenly it's trendy. Call it pottage, and people think of workhouses.
The rebranding challenge of the millennium.
Some marketing firm could make a fortune. Pottage, it's not what Dickens told you. And now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the 1780s, road builders in the Roman tradition applied a technique of mixing volcanic ash with lime to create a self-healing mortar, a chemical reaction that produced calcium aluminum silicate hydrate crystals, which actually grew stronger when exposed to seawater. This same mineral formation was independently discovered in the Solomon Islands, where coral-based lime was used to bind crushed shell aggregate in coastal paths.
In the Solomon Islands? Of course there are!
Self-healing mortar. I don't even know what to do with that.
Pottage connects medieval peasants to modern Shabbat tables, and Roman road chemistry connects Italy to the Solomon Islands. The through line of human ingenuity, I suppose. Cook it long enough, it holds together.
That's actually a perfect summary. We've been making things work with what we have for thousands of years, whether it's dinner or roads. The techniques survive when they solve a real problem.
This has been My Weird Prompts, thanks to our producer Hilbert Flumingtop. If you enjoyed this episode, we'd love a review wherever you listen. Find more at My Weird Prompts.
Until next time.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep, the stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close, from sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.